Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by bellacatering.com.au. Guys, as we are clamping down in Australia, particularly on even harsher quarantine zones, the international border lockdown has happened, the local state border lockdown has happened, and COVID-19 is just not slowing down fast enough. So catering companies like Bella Catering have flipped into home delivery. If you guys go to bellacatering.com.au, you can find an insane array of beautiful home cooked meals that can be delivered to your door. They are still an essential service. Why go out and brave shopping centers with absolute crazy people who want to sneeze coronavirus right into your face? Why not just stay online and order delicious catering from bellacatering.com.au? Glenn, Maria, the team, they're absolutely fantastic. Get onto their website right now. I definitely highly recommend the look of the butter chicken and the individualized $4 cheesecakes. Do it right now. You have to. And now, onto the show. Bernstein and Woodward took a cab to the Library of Congress and found the office that handles the White House request for material in the library. Speaking to the reporters in a hallway rather than his office, a librarian informed them politely that White House transactions were confidential. Eventually, the reporters found a more cooperative clerk and spent the afternoon in the reading room sorting through thousands of slips of paper. Every request since July 1971 when Hunt was hired by the White House.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is a defector from Czechoslovakia, a former professional hockey player, and now a really great film editor who's currently working on a million things. And if you haven't seen the films that he's worked on or edited, one thing you can do is just simply go to one of his most gloriously and celebratory spots, his little stakeout on the internet, which is his Twitter. And if you go there, what you'll find is just this immense amount of material and love and adoration and analysis of cinematic art. How many shots per length, average shots before cuts for different directors, you know, full breakdowns of beautiful scenes, especially, you know, of interest to anyone who's listening to your 1 8-minute production of the how many shots are actually in Michael Mann's centerpiece heist shootout in Heat. And he's just a friend of the series that we've done and a friend of the show and just someone I love talking to about all things cinematic craft. It is the awesome Vashi Nidermansky. Vashi, thank you so much for coming back and talking to me about this one.
Blake, thank you so much for having me back, and thank you for what you do, because this and the Heat podcast, literally, I can't wait for each episode to come out. I learn so much. I revisit films that mean so much to me, and the act of being able to break it down, be it via craft or just emotion and all those components of filmmaking that are equally important, it's really, really fun. It's like a film school without having to leave the house, so I can sit in my own have this conversation.
Well, just in case I didn't mention in that opening, it is at Vashi Koo. So if you guys want to listen, scroll along as you're listening. But Vashi is, we've been admiring the split diopter work of All the President's Men during the beginnings of All the President's Minutes. And I was like, all right, we've got to get you on this show quick. And the minute you guys would know from reading it, as it's popped up in your podcast feeds today, is the 30th minute. And it really has, you know, one of the most iconic shots in all of cinema, and it's super exciting to be talking to you about it. And just in the lead up, I think what I didn't realize before really knuckling down and preparing for this specific moment is just some real beautiful, effortless character work, even in the way the scene is edited. So I'm just dying to talk to you about it.
Oh, I can't wait. There's literally so many little things happen in this minute that are so striking and so evocative and important to the story. And it tells you like what's actually happening behind the scenes, you know, the big business and the big capitalists and the government against the little man. And it's all right there laid out so beautifully.
Tell me a little bit about, before we dive into the minute proper, tell me about, like, you know, you're a studious, you know, a film consumer. And I want to know what your thoughts of Pakula are as, or Pakula, as a filmmaker. He seems to escape some of the gush that we garner to that whole era of filmmakers who sort of had an enduring legacy or influence over many, many other filmmakers that followed them. When you're looking at some of his stuff and thinking, you know, his sort of trio here of Klute and then Parallax and then All the Presidents, can you tell me a little bit about some of the craft that you're, you know, you've marveled at or you've studied with his stuff? Because I'm really curious.
Yeah, I think the one of the most important things is, yes, this is part of the conspiracy era of the 70s when films tended to be dark and moody like that. I think with Pakula, all his films, it sets a really amazing tone.
Yes.
And that's a combination of all the crafts and components of filmmaking. And to be able to sustain that for 2 hours and tell a story and let everyone become so involved and you're drawn into the story, that's the true mark of, like, that's his directorial style to me, that moody tone. It's dreadful. It's scary at some times. It's just impending doom.
Yes.
And, you know, usually you go to the theater, you want to have a positive experience or you want to, whatever, get away and enjoy a film. But yes, this is just as enjoyable. And in that era of the 70s, that was day to day. That was reality. It was impending doom from both the Cold War and the internal government issues going on and everything else. So he, you know, he was capturing the tone of that time in that era. And he did it so beautifully and effortlessly. And I agree with you. He doesn't get the recognition he deserves, but I mean, true cinephiles definitely know who he is, know his work, and enjoy his work. And those three films I find extremely rewatchable, and I'm sure we'll get into that, because what can make a film? Why would you want to watch All the President's Men? I mean, I've watched it 30 times, 40 times. I put it on in my office. It's like a friend. It's like a conversation that's happening next to me, and I'm eavesdropping on that conversation, and it just makes me feel good because it's never rushed, it's never hurried.
Yes,
there's so many little moments, and they're just so enjoyable to devour. And I always come back to All the President's Men.
That's such a mark of an editor, and I love that you said it is like the timing, because timing is so essential to your craft, and timing is so essential to the craft of movies just in general. Is because, as you said, a huge compliment for this movie is that it's not rushed. It's very deliberately paced, and it's tense, and the tension is just ratcheting up like by the smallest increment, by grain of sand, before you realize that the weight is crushing by the end of the movie, and that's the kind of the mark of the artistry. But a bad movie, like this movie, is 138 minutes long.
Doesn't feel like it.
Doesn't feel. And I was. I won't say the movie, but I was watching a movie that I got 43 minutes through last night, a contemporary film, and
yeah,
that felt like I'd spent 43 minutes in the ring with Tyson Fury. Like I was just, I was just being. He's 6'9". He's got those long arms. I was just being battered. I felt awful, and it is such a mark of like timing, tone, mood, pace, like knowing when to turn up the pace, knowing when to bring it down. And I just was like, oh my God, this is such a punish. This is why I find myself occupying these little spaces of deep dives to really, you know, to really absorb something that is really elevated levels of mastery. But look, let's get to this minute. It's 29 minutes on your dial if you're watching it all the way up to the 30th minute. And Vashi and I are going to watch it. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
You want all the material requested by the White House? All White House transactions are confidential. Thank you very much, John.
You need a sympathetic face. We're not going to find one here. You want every request since when?
When did he start?
July of 71.
I imagine the whole last year.
I'm not sure you want them, but I got them.
Wow.
There it is, my friend.
Love it. I absolutely love that. Oh my God, there's a thousand things to talk about in that 1 minute, which you wouldn't think seemed possible. And I don't know how you have the stamina every minute of this film to go in fresh and not be overwhelmed, but still every single time present so many beautiful comments and observations. It's a real skill. I don't know how you have the endurance.
Oh, thank you. Look, I genuinely think it's all about the film. It's all about the film. I think you've just got to love it so deeply and be able to marvel at it. Like in these few minutes, you know, even as we kick this minute off, I get excited by just things like how smart it is to not have these two guys walking up the stairs together. Like what a choice. It's such a nothing choice that other films would just totally, well, let's have them standing next to each other. But no, right. It says so much more about their character.
They're staggered. And with that first shot, you know, first of all, you know, they come towards the camera, they pan around, we see the huge building, they're walking upstairs, it's an uphill battle. I mean, that imagery is very straightforward. There's the little tiny images against the big building, the big government. And yes. One nice little touch, which I did when I was an eighth, doing their eighth grade tour, which is what we do in, you know, North America. You go to in the United States, you go to Washington in eighth grade and you see all the buildings and you visit with a senator and you go to Arlington and
yes.
To see them all coming down the stairs as they're going in just reminded me of my, it's a really nice touch.
And the big one is also just as a character moment, it's Bernstein racing up the stairs ahead. Like,
yeah.
There's still this conflict at the beginning of the story. Even though they're on the story and they're partnering, there's still this little inkling of, God, I just want to be first. Woodward's more deliberate cadence. He's like, this is how fast things are. This is how long it's going to take. This is what's happening.
Yes.
It's a really beautiful
thing. Yeah, no, just they're acting with their bodies, not saying a word, and you see and you understand everything, their relationship, what's important to each person. You know, Hoffman has to have his character in there first. He has to be first through the door. He has to be ahead. And the next thing that I find amazing is that, you know, we overlap the dialogue of the first clerk in the library.
Yes.
And he's answering a question that the characters didn't ask. Because you don't need to ask. You know what they're going there for.
Yes.
So the efficiency of the editing by giving the answer to a question you didn't hear is awesome.
And also
the brevity of that, the economy is great.
And it's so cool because you just made some great comparisons to, you know, it's an uphill battle. They're going up those stairs. They're going to this huge government building. And then the face of bureaucracy fills the screen. So, like, you know, you're right there. And this guy's big, boring face answering an unanswered, unseen question is just like a big talking head in a documentary, even more extreme than that because it's even closer. It's even tighter than like a talking head. It's not at his, you know, his second button from a framing perspective. It's right there in his face. And it's I think they call that a Montana shot, or it's like your button. But it's like that. It's not that. It's right in his face. And it's like, you want everything? No, they're all confidential. And then he seems like this big, intimidating thing, but then as they're framed and walk away and chart their way down that hallway, there's a beautiful, like, there's a beautiful sort of way that the bureaucracy is just, even though it seems so big and it's hard to overcome, it's just someone at a desk. It's just someone following an order. Like, it's just someone who's not even looking around why they might be sniffing around. It's just like, we're going to maintain the order here. We're going to follow the process. And that can be the most tiring thing. Like these slow yeses to everything, like all these.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, that's where I get sort of worn down in this movie. I love that little shot because it's this big, intimidating face that says no. And then it's just a guy behind a desk A boring desk.
He's all by himself.
He's all by himself
in a dark room, and he probably doesn't interact with anyone. And if he does, his answer is no right away, like an insurance company. Once you file your first claim, they literally say no 100% of the time, so you go away and don't come back and ask again.
Yes.
So his default is no.
Yes.
And he doesn't even want to know why. And it's horrifying. You know what's interesting about that shot when we first see him? It reminded me, the way it was lit, and maybe this is a Pakula thing, but it reminded me of in Parallax View when the guy comes to Warren Beatty's apartment and he's standing in the doorway trying to indoctrinate him and get him to come in. And he's lit the same way. It's really dark and there's just two little pinpoints of light in his eyes. And he looks really sinister. And that was very similar lighting to the first close-up here in the Library of Congress, what he looked like. It was shadowed face and two little points of light in his eyes, and he looks really sinister.
He looks sinister and then boring. It's like that beautiful thing of like it's sinister and immediately boring. In Parallax, everything's sinister. Like the whole movie wants to eat you. Like what a crazy relationship for Willis to work with Pakula for those movies too. Like oh my goodness, like they just must have had. I don't know. They're his eyes. Like that their connection. It's just scintillating. It's just so, so, so great in every part of this.
Totally.
So then we go down this hallway. They're sort of stuttering down the hall. And then I love that it's just this working class dude who's like, you want everything from here? Like for the last years, like I got it. Like do it.
literally my favorite line reading the film is, I'm not sure you want them, but I got them.
It's like, just the music. The music is so beautiful in that delivery.
And that guy, I had to look it up. His name is Jay Stewart, and he plays the librarian, and that was his only film role ever.
Ever?
So I don't know if he maybe worked there or whatever, but he killed it. He killed his, like, two lines. It was so authentic and just threw it away and just put perfect delivery.
Jay Stewart, perfect delivery. I hope you were a librarian and that's the only reason why you're not in more movies. But no, it is. No, it's just like it's such a great offset and it's that. And it's, you know, it's the times where the movie is able to have a cultural dialogue but not be showy about it, just be like matter of fact. You know, this guy who is part of the system, who is sort of ingrained in this bureaucracy, is seeing threats from the outside, doing that insurance claim thing of 100% of the time saying no. Whereas in this instance, there's one very, very, very particular, you know, request that's coming through and someone doesn't see the harm in it. Like someone who's still got that, there's no cynicism in his reading of it. It's like, oh, you want to look at it? Okay. Like what?
That's his job. His job is to relay and get the information that you request. And he has pride in his job. And he knows it where it is. He knows it's a shit ton of it, and he's going to bring it to
you. and also, what could be there? What could be so telling about a library slip is his mind, right? Like, it feels like it's like he's just so casual, like, oh, I've got it. Like, I don't see why anyone would see that this is a problem to see what library books they're hiring out.
You know what's interesting? That when they're walking down the hallway, the line is, we need to find some, you know, what was it like? We got to find someone with a friendly face.
Yes,
is the line in the script? It says we got to find someone who's not a bureaucrat.
Yes.
So there's that distinction, just to not help us along, but just to take a little sharpness off it. Like, let's go find not a bureaucrat. That's kind of harsh.
Yeah,
let's find a friendly face.
Plays tougher. Let's find a friendly face because these guys are all the whole movie is a. Like a Rorschach test for the friendly face. Like open a door. Is this going to be a friendly face? No. This person doesn't want to talk. See ya. Like it just is like this cycle of those things going over and over again. But we get our friendly face and then we slam down these hundreds of cards and it does that most graceful zoom out. Elevated shot coming up into the Library of Congress and starts. And if we weren't already knowing it was an uphill David v. Goliath battle, their mountain of cards and this mountainous room starts to sort of open up and you just see that they're these tiny specks of dust that are there. While again, they're these tiny specks in the newsroom and they're these tiny specks in a library and it just arcs up to this absolutely gorgeous staging of that Library of Congress shot. It eclipses into the next minute.
I can't believe they let him get away with that shot to even shoot it there to that extent. But I love the fact that when it cuts, again, the editing, when the when Jay Stewart, the librarian, he responds to a question not asked as well.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
You want what? You want all the data? So again, it's that repetitive of that editing style, and then the smash cut to the cards, like you said. And then that sound, I love the sound of the thumbs and fingers pulling the cards. Oops. It's that ASMR, like, perfect sound. Shuffling of the papers.
Oh my God. ASMR dream for me too is when you hear paper being pulled out of a rubber band stack, like it's like a baseball card or like a collector's card when you're a kid, and an action figure card or whatever it is, and you're like pulling them out, and you can hear that. It's just so great. But you just touched on something that I think there's a question, and we'll come back to the ASMR of it all, but there's a question that like a lot of people ask or sort of scratch their head with, and I think you might have started like triggering it, is it is such an effectively edited movie because essentially you're following, you know, the major criticism to this movie, and it even comes to someone as brilliant as Roger Ebert. The major criticisms of the movie is the repetition. And I think that what maybe wasn't appreciated at the time, but certainly, you know, aged like a fine wine, is like, no, the repetition is intentional. Like the repetition is, it is all part of the mode of this story being told. And then you've got Robert L. Wolf, which is going, well, you know, as an editor, how do we make it more dynamic and how do we make this thing move as quickly as we want to move it? And that's a great technique, because if you're repeating the questions over and over and over again, the repetitions would be tiresome. You would start going, oh, this is just like, stop. Can we stop this? Whereas if you are doing exactly what you said and being really clever, like we don't need to know what question they're going to ask, because in the previous scene, they've already asked, they've already established how they would grill this person.
What they're after.
And then it gives, you know, this gives editor Robert L. Wolf and Pacula together sitting down to go, okay, well, this is how we can do this. We know what we need to do here.
Completely accurate. And as an editor, you know, this film, the pacing of it, it's like up against the wall every time. They're hitting walls. They're stumbling blocks everywhere. It's death by a thousand cuts. Everywhere they go, they're getting turned down. And they're just trying to get one little nugget to get them to the next place, to the next clue, to the next little crumb, to follow the right trail.
Yes.
And what I think this film does that is so beautiful is we are with the two leads. We only know what they know. We never learn something that they don't know. So we're learning along with them. So it gives us some leeway to have them go all these places, ask these questions, because we're just as curious as they are to find out that next nugget. If we knew something they didn't, the illusion crumbles.
Yes.
You could see behind the curtain. And that's all, you know, that's part of obviously the writing and the editing, trying to maintain that pacing, that flow, that rhythm, but giving you enough crumbs where you're not bored, but also you're just always curious and you're always searching for that next clue. And to sustain and maintain that for over 2 hours is no easy task.
No. And to know exactly. And so obviously Deep Throat being Mark Felt plays a huge role in, you know, that eventual dump of information, but we need to like propel the story into its next level. It's those really calculated decisions to go, I'm going to let them butt their heads against that wall over and over again. And now I'm going to give them a big injection of information that's going to propel them on the next thing. So the pace then that they're learning about things then increases and you get that beautiful pace firing again, and then it'll crawl to a stop and then something happens. It's just very, I don't know, it's just like this hyper awareness of how the flow of the story is going to work in the way that it's executed, that you just go, man, this is real mastery on show, from the alchemy of all these people working together to know how everything needed to be paced so perfectly to make this engaging.
Absolutely. In film editing, I use a technique that I call micro-macro.
Yes.
In terms of when I'm editing a scene, I'm obviously concerned about the scene, how it has to play, but I'm also thinking the scene as one brick in the wall, and how is it going to affect the pacing? Because oftentimes novice editors or people that aren't experienced, they'll edit a scene, move on to the next scene, and they'll only think of it as that one moment. But those moments are all strung together.
Yes.
And they create an act and then a sequence, you know, and then the entire film. So one scene that's out of whack, be it pacing or rhythm or tone, can, again, bring the whole picture down.
Yeah.
And it won't play. So, you know, you always, always have to be thinking and, you know, small and big at the same time in context to each other to maintain that rhythm and flow, which appears to be effortless, but is definitely not. No. It's a process.
Imagine our technology now, Vashi, right? And how still hard finding that balance is. And you as an editorial consultant in the modern world, in the digital world, you know, and working with, you know, all this like digital footage and how things rendered, there's still time being taken to sort of edit and cut things together and get it into these chunks. But imagine if it's reel to reel, like, and you're there on a reel to reel and you're trying to cut it to get to this level of flow. It must have been just...
That's daunting. Yeah.
A daunting effort.
On Deadpool, I worked on that for 9 months. We had 550 hours of raw footage.
God.
And I did the math just for shits and giggles. And if you were to watch 40 hours a week, just to look at the footage the first time, it would take you 18 weeks working 40 hours a week to watch all the footage once.
Jesus.
So, I mean, the shooting ratio on that is extremely huge. I don't know what it was on All the President's Men, but I guarantee it, you know, maybe 100 hours or 150 hours or something, you know, incrementally a lot smaller than what we can do with digital and how we just film so much today just to capture it. But yeah. Ugh. But in this scene, if we want to talk about that shot, I mean, the glorious shot in the Library of Congress, you know, the first time I saw it, again, you're overwhelmed because you hear the sound of the paper, you hear the score coming in, we're pulling up and up, and they actually, you know, the room, the Library of Congress, that center room is like 130 feet high, and they actually created a wooden crate on a pulley with the camera pointing down that started right very close, obviously, to the hands and to the cards, and then they slowly pulled it up on a pulley up to the ceiling, which is 120 feet. And it took like 3 minutes to pull it all the way up. And that's why there's those two edits in the middle of the maneuver as it's going up, because you couldn't let it roll that way naturally. But with those edits, those dissolves, again, it's implying the time is passing. They have so many papers to look through that, you know, it's letting you know that they're spending hours and hours trying to find that one little nugget in there, and it's going to take them some time. When they were pulling up the camera, they actually had guidelines on the side, like fishing wire, to try and keep it steady, because, you know, pulling a free floating camera up to the ceiling,
up a pulley, it's just going to spin like a top. You know, that's exactly what I was thinking. God, they must have had some kind of rig to keep it stable and to keep it steady, that when you got running up, because that would have just been a freaking nightmare.
Yeah, they had the main rope going straight up, and they had two guidelines going out to the side to try and stabilize it. And then they did this shot two times in total in that room.
Wow.
And, you know, reset it, and then they just used the best part of it, the one that was the most stable. But even when it reaches the top, there's that little wiggle left and right where it's just kind of, you know, still twisting around because it's just hanging in air. But what a shot. I mean, to look down and see, you know, our two leads just like little ants, just like nothing, which is the theme. Every time we see these guys, they're coming out of a building. It's this monstrously huge thing behind them, and they're little tiny images in the foreground. You know, this is played out so many times, and it really lets you know that it not only is an uphill battle, but it's, you know, David versus Goliath whole time.
It's also there's something so cool now, like, you know, I just want to sort of frame that we get so spoilt for going, you walk into that room and you want that shot, and someone has to, like, get on scaffolding, get on rigging, go and drill a hole in the roof, or build a rig that is there to then mount a pulley to test the pulley with, you know, probably a person. You know, they have to get permission from the Library of Congress to drill a hole in the roof. They then have to do it and make it either a closed set, shooting at night, whatever, or shooting in the day and close it, and just guarantee, hey, we're only going to shoot for a couple of hours and then we're done, and I'll pack up this rig and we'll see you later. But the vision to have the shot, and then the craft that then goes into actually building it and then doing it and executing it, and the sort of ingenuity of, like, we really want this shot because it's going to underscore thematically what we're trying to go for with this entire character journey. I just also love that, because now that's a drone shot and it's freaking easy. Like, people are so spoiled right now. Like, you could sit down, like, I guarantee you, you know, I'm as I'm recording this podcast, like, I'm planning an LA trip a little later in the year. And I can imagine that if I, like, did a quick dart to Washington, D.C. on a domestic domestic flight. Like, if I took a drone with me, I could make that shot happen. Like, I could be sitting in the Library of Congress if I didn't get in trouble for using a drone. I could make that drone shot happen and go, there's my older president's men shot, and I'm good. Thank you very much. And you walk out of there in 5 minutes. But it's just like, it's just impossible to even conceive of that back in those days. And it's just like so great that they did it and they had to sort of deal with whatever that organic, you know, little shake is. I don't think it takes anything away from the shot. I think it just completely works.
Yeah, not at all. It doesn't bother me at all. No. And what's interesting, again, in the shooting script, this shot is not in the script. It says that they were looking through the cards, digging, and then it says three omitted shots that weren't in the script. So again, I'd love to find out if they, on the day or like previously, were like, listen, we should get this shot, because that's a hell of an ask to tell the director, or even if Pakula said, you know what, I love a shot that starts close to them and goes straight up to the ceiling of the Library of Congress up 120 feet. Let's make that happen. The logistics of just trying to get that going must have been ridiculous.
And to your point as well, it's like, to do that, it's a long time to do it. They're not shooting a lot in Washington. They are shooting in Burbank quite a bit, because the whole Washington Washington Post office is in Burbank, so they're doing all that shooting there. So they're shooting on location. They do this, and you know, this is one of those things where it's the alchemy of this is that it is William Goldman's script, but it had a lot of influence from Redford himself and Pakula going, okay, we want to do this, and this is how we're going to do it, and this is the story we're telling. So that's super interesting. But one thing we haven't mentioned yet, which I think I wanted to talk about really quickly, is like just the introduction of the score. Like, this is like one of the first moments in the entire film where there's an overt piece of score. Now, there's other little tinkerings that we may have heard up until this minute, but this sort of theme of the movie, which is so sparsely used, but it's used to such great effect, is like its pronouncement here and its sort of introduction is this lulling feeling you're going into it, but it's also like, wow, like, there's been no music in this movie and I'm on the edge of my seat. There's not a lick of music and I'm freaking excited. It's such a strange concept, but it's so great that it's like, this is the scene that shows you, oh, there's really not, we're not playing this to toy with your emotions. We don't need the music as an additional manipulator here. We've got you covered in the writing, the performances, and in the editing.
No, David Shire's score and all his scores are always so magnificent and so just different. It's not minimalist at all. It's perfect for the movie, perfect for the scene. Like, it's almost to the point you don't even realize the music is playing, because as you noted, there's very little, if anything, up to this point. And then it comes in and it's like the heavens are opening in terms of you're adding another layer onto the story, and it may be cueing us that they're on the right path. It may be cueing us that whatever, something's happening, but it is telling us something. And I think that you've made the point that today, in like almost everything, be it on streaming or films, like, it's just buried under music. It's just so much music at all times, cues that are on the nose that are telling you what to feel. And there is very little silence. People are scared of silence. Like, producers are scared of silence because they think they're going to lose the audience. And so they just shower, you know, everything with music at all times. And it's so powerful to have no music. And when something does come in, it's so much more effective.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the real power of a great needle drop or a great score is like, when, especially when a movie's gone for so long and it's so deliberate for something to come in, like, over the top. Or, you know, I think horror movies have a real command of silence and then like a blaring radio or something like that. You know, it doesn't feel like that in this movie as an example, but it's just that more awareness that silence is a real creep, and like just some little, you know, making people agonize over that is a whole technique in and of itself. But yeah, it's just a great choice when you're thinking about, and you know, so many adaptations of or recreations of past, like, this is a dramatization that's, you know, being made in 75 about a story that happened in 72, so it, you know, and an unfolding drama that concludes in 74. So like, they've got a lot of the primary source material. They know
it's such a quick turnaround, unbelievably quick turnaround. That's, oh my God. Can you imagine?
I mean, I can't fathom that a movie this big with this many stars for Warner Brothers, it's a studio film that probably took a year to shoot. He's released on the 1st of Jan in 76 to compete for Oscar. And all of that happens, and when you then do a little bit of research, as we've done for the podcast, is that Redford is talking to Woodward and Bernstein while they're not even finished writing the book. Like, he's like, you need to write the book, and when you write the book, I want the rights to the book, you know?
Right.
And to think of that, so he could be talking to them in like 72, 73, have to have it locked down by 74. Because then the final days comes out, which is their accounts of literally the final days of Nixon's time in office. And it's just like all this, there's no distance between the real life events and then the film producers waiting in the wings here. It's kind of, and that is a very problematic thing to happen. You know, in the great, Scott Z. Burns' excellent movie, and I recommend it to anyone who has a Prime subscription. Scott Z. Burns' great movie called The Report is available on Amazon Prime. And it actually takes some swipes.
I watched it twice.
So excellent, right? Such an excellent movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it takes some swipes, very, very fair swipes at Zero Dark Thirty. Because, you know, unfortunately for Catherine Bigelow, her team were embedded with CIA resources and were getting information about everything that was unfolding with the Osama bin Laden raids and all of the investigation to find his location. But it was a very propagandistic view that they were receiving from their contacts. And so when they were so immediate and able to create this movie and be sort of almost feel like they're in production while the story is unfolding, there's such a problematic thing, because a few years later, people like in Scott Z. Burns' Stalker can go, hey, this is just a CIA propaganda film. And it calls it all into question. So it just becomes this, it's just, you know, it becomes part of the myth of the movie of like, how did it actually come together?
How did it come together in that frame? And the fact that it was so quick, I mean, they shot for 96 days, which is,
oh my goodness,
you know, it's a good chunk of time. And, you know, that's not every day. I'm sure they spread it out. So factor that into the timeline of actual events happening, and also the huge concern of getting it right, because history will tell if you told the story the right way. I'm not saying it's a documentary, but it feels like a documentary a lot of the time in terms of like revisiting it.
Yes.
Because it's nailing all this stuff. And then, you know, we get Deep Throat years later, we get confirmation of who it was. But that was always a great mystery to have that strung along for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
But it's special. It's really special.
It is. It's so special. And it's even funnier. Just, I love to mention it when I get a chance, is like Hal Holbrook looks exactly like Mark Felt. Like, it's undeniable. Like, he just looks so much like him. And it's even funnier that Woodward, like when they were choosing actors, you know, Woodward had a real, he's like, you know, yeah, Hal Holbrook's the guy. And it's like, if, you know, however many years later we actually learned of the facts, it's like, yeah, well, I mean, if you just held that guy up against anyone who was a high-ranking officer in the intelligence service in America, you might go, God damn it, Hal Holbrook looks like you, Mark Felt.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like people, even when the movie was released, Mark, Hal Holbrook looks just like you. Has anyone ever told you that? You know, I want to be in that office scene, like the comedy sketch version of like, hey, Mark, Hal Holbrook looks just like you. Like, it's crazy.
Right. Oh my God. I mean, and that speaks to the casting of this film. Like, every character is perfect.
Yeah.
I can't see anyone else in any other scenes, in any other roles. Like, it was just perfectly cast.
Yeah, no, it's, and, you know, for all of the, you know, everyone likes to have the more attractive version, the way more attractive version of themselves, as in Bernstein and Woodward, get with Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford, you know, two of the biggest movie stars of their age, and Robert Redford, one of the most beautiful men of all time. But they earn that little piece of Hollywood movie magic fallacy by just terrific embodiments of those characters. Like, they're both doing such phenomenal work to perform those characters and do them justice, and you know, they might look like a more polished and more beautiful version, but it's very, very, very powerful and very affecting nonetheless.
No, well stated. And they were so understated in their performances and so naturalistic, which is something that I find is not present today so much, maybe in my viewpoint. Like, there's something about that era of the 70s where, you know, they don't look, they're not dressed perfectly. Something's rumpled, you know, part of that's the character, but their performances are so naturalistic. I can't even express, you know, what the difference is now and then, but there's something about it. It just feels right.
It's, yeah, there's, I don't know whether it's like a flavor of melodrama coming back into fashion or something like that. But yeah, there's just something, you know, when you see a really true and naturalistic and completely understated, under-delivered almost performance, it's really refreshing. You're like, oh, like this is, there's no artifice on this. They're just trying to give you something authentic. And I think that, you know, it's funny, the report, we talked about it now twice, and I think it's definitely going to come up as we keep going, knowing how much of a fan that Scott C. Burns and Soderbergh are of this movie particularly.
Sure.
It's impossible. We were even talking about how much of a fan Soderbergh is and how much Contagion almost feels in the same, you know, it feels like it's the same kind of expression as All the President's Men, but for a much, much different topic.
We were talking about that before. It's just Contagion, just like All the President's Men, is just very matter of fact. It's just presenting information, and we're moving forward, and we're just along for the ride, and it's a scary ride.
Yes,
in both those films.
Absolutely.
There's one actor that that we're talking about, the naturalism. That do you know Bill Camp, the actor? He looks like Jack Warden, funny enough. And he was in The Looming Tower. He was in Dark Water.
Oh, yes, I know Bill Camp. Yes, I do. I couldn't place him with his name. He's in so many things. People would know him for things like Joker. He's also in 12 Years a Slave. Yes. But a couple of things that I want to say that he's absolutely phenomenal in. He is absolutely phenomenal in Killing of a Sacred Deer. He's in.
Yes.
He's also in Midnight Special, which he's just wonderful in. Yeah, he's all across the board great character actor.
And he's in The Outsider right now.
Oh yes, yes. He's just.
So, I just love watching him, and sometimes you can't even. I look at him and I don't even recognize him.
And, yes.
And it's not from overacting or anything else or underacting. It's just he transforms himself, and that's. He feels of that era of the 70s. Like, he feels of, he could have been in that film as well. And, you know,
yeah,
I appreciate
it. He could be in one of those editorial meetings, Bill Camp. He would find he'd find a place with a ruffled white shirt and nicotine stains on his hands. Like, he's the guy for one of those scenes. Absolutely. And that's the highest compliment I think we can give. Look, Vashi, it's absolutely always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. This has been really wonderful. And when we talk about craft together, I get really excited because you just place things so beautifully and talk about the practicality of how scenes must string together to have that sort of make the overall tone of the movie. And I love those micro and macro discussions and cutting off questions. Yeah. I think that's if people who are now listening and this is your, you know, 30th episode with us, I think that's one of those things you're going to go back and probably agonize over, is like, how many times do we know what kind of question they've asked and we just stumble straight into the answer to continue to maintain our momentum? And I think asking the question again and again in some scenes is precisely because they're not going to get the answer they want. So that might just be a whole other thing we've stumbled on in the art of this movie.
We got lots of minutes left to readdress that. But thank you so much for having me on, Blake. It's always a privilege and an honor, and to share these thoughts and comments on films that we love so much, and to get really into the minutiae of everything is exciting, and it shows how deep not only this film is, but the entire craft of filmmaking. It's not just turning on a camera and having people run around. It's such a detailed art, and it should be respected and understood more.
Thank you, my friend. It's a pleasure to have you. And undoubtedly, as we go on, you'll be back. So we look forward to having you back on the show, whether it's for another episode of All the President's Minutes or one of the next madcap deep dives that we dive down. So thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Absolutely. Anytime you need me, I'll be there. Thank you, Blake.
My incredible guest, of course, is Vashi Nidermansky. At VashiQ, VashiKoo on Twitter. You need to follow him. VashiVisuals.com. I mean, he's an essential follow. He's a phenomenal person. I really feel honored and privileged to be able to sort of talk to a true artist who's working and a technician like Vashi every time. And with just such a storied life, he's just wonderful. So Vashi, thank you again, my friend, for being a part of the show. It's always a treat. This has been another One Heat Minute production. Thank you so much for listening along. We have an amazing array of shows. One Heat Minute, obviously, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Increment Vice, Josie and the Podcats, all the President's Minutes, which you're listening to today, and our daily podcast, Con-10-Gen, which is a tight 10 talking to a whole stack of folks in isolation, in quarantine, sort of accounting for, in this community, everything that's going down. Listen along to that daily. We're going to have great shows coming up for you, some unannounced stuff, which we are going to announce to tease for the future. But if you want to support us, we do have a Patreon, and you can find links to that on oneheatminute.com. If you want to go to our site, oneheatminute.com or incrementvice.com, you can find out more about the shows. And if you want to go to graffitiwithpunctuation.com, you can read about Contingent and our upcoming 6-part limited series, Josie and the Podcats. Until next time, thank you so much. Subscribe, rate, review, share. Thanks so much for listening.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024. Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.